Welcome to Impact AI, brought to you by Pixel Scientia Labs. I'm your host, Heather Couture. On this podcast, I interview innovators and entrepreneurs about building a mission-driven, machine learning-powered company. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to my newsletter to be notified about new episodes. Plus, follow the latest research in computer vision for people in planetary health. You can sign up at pixelscientia.com/newsletter. Today, I'm joined by guest Noelia Jimenez-Martinez, Head of Insights and Machine Learning at NatureMetrics, to talk about biodiversity monitoring. Noelia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you and talking about this very interesting subject.
Noelia, could you share a bit about your background and how that led you to NatureMetrics?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. So I was born in Argentina in a piece of Las Yungas forest that's disappearing super quickly. And I studied astrophysics because I was super curious about the sky and the stars. The landscape permits you to see a huge amount of stars during the night, the whole Milky Way, actually. So my map of nature started with astrophysics. I did a PhD in computational astrophysics, study chemical evolution of galaxies. And I stayed in academia for a long time, did 3 postdocs in different universities in Europe. At some point for me, it was crucial to have a better project in mind. I couldn't focus too much on solving galaxy formation with the amount of bad news I was seeing on the climate space and biodiversity collapse. So basically, I made a transition on purpose, looking for jobs to apply the skills I built all these years into related problems to climate and biodiversity. So I was very successful to transition into, because obviously it was the time to do it as well. Worked in London, the data science consultant, and then as a head of data science for a company. I even pitched a company doing biodiversity and AI, was told it was too early. So I joined Microsoft, worked as a sustainability global lead, specialized even more on sustainability and AI. Yeah, all that built a really nice case for me to be in NatureMetrics now.
So what does NatureMetrics do, and why is it so important for sustainability in the world?
So yeah, NatureMetrics is a company that started specializing in eDNA analysis. So this is the genetic material that organisms shed into the environment through, for example, skin, feces, or urine. By analyzing that from soil, water, and air, what you create is a very unique data set of species on the ground. So this is a ground truth method to understand ecosystems. That's the starting point of NatureMetrics. What we are doing now is integrating all this data with all the data layers, like remote sensing, satellite data, bioacoustics, camera traps, etc. And so we are standing on a huge amount of layers that and help us understand how an ecosystem actually thrives. The company is focused on moving from just eDNA to giving a technology that it's going to be able to, and does already, protect biodiversity and helps to enhance biodiversity by giving very specific quantitative ways to monitor the ecosystem and the biodiversity.
And what role does machine learning play in this technology?
A huge one. So to start with, the biodiversity mapping, the biodiversity monitoring will obviously collect, integrate data from different sources. And for that, the intelligence that you need to bring in order to actually have an insight will obviously rely on recognition of patterns, understanding hierarchical modeling of ecology. All those are machine learning algorithms. But on top of that, what we are doing now is creating a transferable AI model that can pick up the complexities of ecosystems. For this, we use deep neural networks. So what we want is a training model that will pick up the correlations between species and other environmental variables like temperature, precipitation, land cover, you name it. And this continuous map of species and distributions are what we will provide and we have as a baseline to give companies an understanding on how their operations affect the biodiversity of the landscapes they operate. It's related to machine learning in terms of the modeling we do. Obviously, it's a conglomerate of different algorithms, but also we are innovating with the use of, for example, large language models for internal tools. We might eventually launch an external tool on biodiversity and large language models, but Yeah, I will say it plays a huge role in what we do.
Can you give some specific examples of the types of models you train, like what the input looks like, what the output looks like, perhaps?
Yeah. So, for example, I had a conversation this morning, for example, with a client that needs to predict invasive species in an area where they operate. So we will have inputs on eDNA on the ground, so different species that were mapped either by soil or water or air. We will integrate that with open source data like GBIF, which is the Global Biodiversity Dataset. That's open source. If we have, let's say, best case scenario, we don't, but if we had camera traps or bioacoustics, we will have that too. And so with all these different layers of data, after a lot of cleaning and normalizing, standardization, etc., we have a picture of which species are present. And for doing that, we run algorithms that are called species distribution models, and others that are called joint distributions of species distribution models. These algorithms are known by the ecological community, obviously. But what is interesting is that we can now add complexity because of these different layers, but also because of the different frameworks to work in machine learning, and accelerate the algorithm's precision, train them at different layers. The new field is actually super, super interesting because we get more and more computational power, yeah, a large data set. So the progress is immense. The output of these algorithms is, for example, a map that we provide where we have recommendations on where these species are present. It's a probabilistic model, obviously. It's not the absolute truth, but it's a probabilistic model of where the species are present. And why is this useful? Because ecosystems are very complex, are nonlinear relations of predators and trophic chains. So the fact that you have a distribution of where species might be, it helps the conservationists, the managers on the land, to specify where the operations are not going to be taking place, for example. And this is important because you can actually stop the declining of species. But also imagine if you have, in this case, the very invasive species that will alter a lot of the ecosystem. In this case, is a species that will probably destroy crops. The fact that you identify where they are, it helps you to have interventions on time. And in that way, you can stop the declining of your crops. And also you can predict, for example, what variables made the species thrive. So yeah, so that's an example of, for example, input output of one of the models we are working on right now.
And you mentioned that this is the input for all of these is environmental DNA data. So what does eDNA data look like?
Have you seen Jurassic Park?
I have, yes.
It's an old movie, but I mean, not for me, but the DNA is a sequence of letters. So in the end, what we got is a piece of all this massive chain of genes that people at the lab, using a method called beta barcoding, can match to a already existing library of species and tell us which species are present. This is something called OTUs. In the end, they produce something called OTUs, which is Organizational Taxonomical Unit. It looks like when you open the raw data for the curious ones, you have an ID, an OTU, which is a ABBCCDD. No, actually, it's the four letters of the DNA. So not ABC, but the AGT adenosina. Do you remember these ones?
The four base pairs. Yeah.
Yes, the base pairs. And so you have that, a combination of that. And then you have, most of times, you have the time where it was picked up from. So yeah, the time of recollection. And also you have location-based data. That's the minimum we need to integrate it with all the sources.
So these are partial strands of DNA that, you know, they're not full sequencing.
Yes, exactly.
Certainly.
No.
Just bits and pieces.
Bits and pieces that they are called base markers. They use that to understand which species is present. So this is a very specific expertise from the bioinformaticians, yes.
How do you gather this data?
So each of these projects we are working on will have a strategy for sampling. So we understand, for example, that different projects will need different things, and also depending on which eDNA you're collecting. If you have, for example, soil data, that's easy to reach. It's easier to reach. And so you can have, even any person can just go and with the kit we send them, collect the data and come back and send it to the lab. that's good enough for us to do the rest of the modeling. Some other samplings are a little bit more complex if they're in places, imagine a mountain or places difficult to reach. So some people have to use drones and they send kits to collect eDNA with drones. But in general, it's an easy process where we send them kits, tell them how to do it. They collect either the water or the soil or even the insects sometimes. We put insect traps and they send them back to the lab and we can process that.
What kinds of challenges do you encounter in working with this type of environmental DNA?
You should talk to the biodiversity. Yeah, you should talk to the bioinformaticians. I will tell you that a huge amount of things. I don't want to oversimplify, but eDNA, it's obviously complex and we are setting the standards on how to do that properly. In principle, one of the most tricky things is that if you don't have access to sites, as I was saying, it's difficult to get to the places where you strategically should be sampling to have a well non-biased data set. So yeah, that's one of the main things. So the ground is, it could be a tricky place to sample. Site level sampling is always going to depend on what do you have. So when you go there and see where, if you can actually reach to that piece of the forest, or it's probably in the middle, there is a river you didn't realize it was there or something like that. Like, it could happen. And that's where we have to be flexible as well in understanding that samplings are biased by this. So we have to correct. And there are many more things very specific on the eDNA. So for example, abundance. It's something we are investigating because it depends actually how do you treat this. There's something called presence absence and many other statistical problems on the eDNA.
So what about when you go to train models based on eDNA? You mentioned bias as one of the challenges there. Are there others? How do you handle them for these unique challenges?
That's actually super important for us. So obviously, like any machine learning practitioner, we test on unseen data and see how well the model performed. But actually, the best way to do it would be to ground truth again. So having a second sample on the place you already sample at least once, to see how is the model performing. Because in other machine learning problems, you just deploy the model and gather new data and see the data drift or whatever you have to correct. In this case, if we sample a place, we produce a map on, let's say, priority of areas to conserve, to protect because of very specific species, we would go again and sample a year later because that's usually how biodiversity conservation works. And also you have to consider seasons. Yes. So in this case, what we want to do, and we have done before, is gather data again from the same place to actually test the performance of the model and be super sure. Also because these are beings, they are living beings. So we want to be responsible as well that we are not underestimating any of the variables.
So in this case, how would you identify that there is a bias and what are some things you might do to mitigate it?
Oh, there are many things on ecosystems that would create a bias. So for example, if you can have a species distribution model that predicts certain species that you, by definition, you can see there because there are some correlations on the environment, like let's say temperature and vegetation, soil moisture. But if you move 2 meters away from that site that you predicted, for some geological historical reason that has nothing to do with your model, those species might not be present. So you cannot really extrapolate. This is very well known by the whole community. And as a person that comes from a different field, it's crazy to see that the machine learning models, well, I mean, this is the question. The machine learning models get so, so good that they will pick up these inferences, even if we don't give them direct data on every ecological and geological event that happened. So yeah, to your question on how do we know and how we test, we have many ways to correct from biases. Good things are to have all the data sources, like the GBIF, for example, or wherever the people that work with us have collected on site. There's also literature of different things that were seen on the site historically. It's not a complete disaster, but it's really hard still because this is new. So we are step-by-step sampling and creating a general map of biodiversity that is going to be at some point the base of how we operate everywhere.
And how broadly can you apply these models? Is it something that you could train in one location and works, you know, in a different geographic area? Or do you need to have a broad set of training data to cover all the regions that you might want to apply it to?
So ideally, yes, we will want to say that. But we are conscious that at this stage of development, you cannot predict on unseen spaces. So this is why it's a very different machine learning problem. Because of what I said before, so nature does not seem to behave like so well as we would want. It might be that you have exactly the same covariates and your model is not, your model is predicting species and then you go and it's not there. And this is because maybe species level is too much for this level of training and learning, but we can go to species richness or to family, to group. So if you think on the hierarchies that you can have from eDNA, it can be generalized. I think the challenge is to keep on giving the system more and more data to see if these interconnections are there at some point.
Are there any specific technological advancements that made it possible to build this technology now? Wouldn't have been feasible even a few years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. So we use a huge amount of deep neural networks. And even if they were around from the 40s and 50s, the real spread on and the advancement of how fast we can train and how fast we can actually process this amount of data sets, I think, is quite new. It's from the 2010 and going. So yeah, we definitely benefit from computational power and optimization of algorithms.
Thinking more broadly about what you're tackling and its importance in the world, how do you measure the impact of the technology?
Yeah, so for us, actually, the whole ecosystem of what's going on right now, so I am using ecosystem in two senses. So at the moment, all companies, most of the companies will have to report on their sustainability strategies in the world to keep on functioning, to keep on operations, to be in business, right? So in that context, what we can do here is make biodiversity monitoring achievable and democratically easy to access. In terms of right now, if you think about how people operate and how they report on supply chains and ecosystem conditions in any company that has anything to do with nature, you will see it's a manual process mostly. And it demands human beings that are specifically trained to detect species from plants to animals to insects, that have to go to the ground and have to go four times a year to be able to collect information of species that are present along the four or seasons, if that happened. So all this is manually intensive, expensive, and takes a huge amount of time. But the worst is that it's not real-time data. When you put all that together, it's probably already too late, and things have changed and moved very quickly because of many other variables like the anthropological impact that we have. So the company, it's operating now to facilitate and to establish methodologies of biodiversity monitoring that use AI to make things faster and easier. The impact for me will be huge, to be honest, if we install and if we help creating biodiversity monitoring methods that are used for the regulatory processes that are coming now, like CSRD or TNFD, which are two frameworks for reporting nature. I think we'll see a change on how biodiversity is affected by companies. I also think that given the system pressures, if you think about how fast the planet is warming and no one really understands why, and what's the ecosystem reaction to that, this is crucial. The fact that we can have a quick model and we can have real-time, almost real-time data, because imagine we have satellite data reading this daily, will be super, super important for everything from supply chains to food supply chains. I think, yeah, that's the impact of this technology.
Is there any advice you could offer to other leaders of AI-powered startups?
I think given that's a very fast-moving field, the fact that all of us are trying to keep updated, it's already, that's the main thing. Like, how do we keep updated? What's important and what's not has been the question I've been asking myself. What's actually important, what's common sense, and what actually really, really, it's deep down skills. So I found that I deeply value the foundational aspects of my education Because by studying general relativity and quantum mechanics, and also applying that to chemical evolution, I find that I can just learn anything and it's not daunting. I find it interesting. Obviously, biodiversity is super complex, is a nonlinear relationships, and it's a huge amount of stats. So it's super interesting to see how these very foundational, as I said, foundational skills help me out today. But I think common sense, maybe everyone will agree that we need to be solving real urgent problems. I would assure you, I've seen a huge amount of AI startups solving problems that I cannot even believe they pose. They are actually something to be spending time on. So I will ask everyone to move their focus to what actually we have in front, which is the climate biodiversity breakdown. And I think that's where we should be investing a huge amount of time, and also resilience and creating, yeah, livable cities for what's coming. I think also it's super important that we address that we need to be transparent and we need to focus on ethics. There's a huge amount of risk on not having accountability of what we are doing with the algorithms. And I think that's a very well-known thing in the industry. The third thing, in my experience, the most important thing I've seen is the success of AI startup. It's really much tied up to the diverse, strong teams you build. So I am passionate about that, bringing people from different backgrounds. Yeah, fostering people that are curious and willing to learn. And yeah, and I think that's what I think is super important as well.
We've already talked a fair amount about impact, but just to close things out, where do you see the impact of nature metrics in 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, so I think I pitched probably a little bit on the other questions you asked, because I think if, given that we have this regulation for all these companies, and companies are asking, how do we do this? How do we measure species richness, ecosystem conditions? How do we give real-time information to companies to be able to change their operations, understand what makes them more resilient to climate and biological changes, basically? It's super important. I think that's the impact. I think these biodiversity monitoring methods and platforms we are building are going to be the standardized thing we'll see across many, many industries in the 3 to 5 years coming.
This has been great. Noelia, I appreciate your insights today. I think this will be valuable to many listeners. Where can people find out more about you online?
So you can find me on LinkedIn, obviously, and you can find all the information about the company. We have a web page. And yeah, that's it. I don't have Twitter or X, should I say it? I've been avoiding a lot making any statements on platforms. But yeah, I'm very reachable through either LinkedIn or web page of a company. And if you need to talk to me personally, I think you can very easily ask for my details at the company's contact form.
I'll link to both LinkedIn and Nature Metrics website in the show notes, so that'll be accessible to everybody. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Heather. This has been great.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Heather Couture, and I hope you join me again next time for Impact AI. Thank you for listening to Impact AI. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share with a friend. And if you'd like to learn more about computer vision applications for people and planetary health, you can sign up for my newsletter at pixelscientia.com/newsletter.